Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 113, being recorded on the 31st of January, 2016, with special guest Russell Young. I am Sujit Mello, and actually I am in Seattle today with Russell sitting right across from me. He's come all the way from the UK, and we'll get into that in a minute as to why we're here in Seattle. But on Skype with me, I have, of course, Kale Teeter, who happens to be in Redmond. Right, Kale?
Yep. I'm over here in Redmond.
And Evans, of course, back.
I got left behind. Don't worry about
that,
guys.
Behind, yes. Slacker. No, I'm just kidding. Guys, yeah, it's good to have Russell here, and we're going to get into what he wants to talk about in just a minute. But I got to bring you guys up to date with some really exciting news. I was actually here yesterday. I came in a day early for a briefing for the Azure Stack product, which the big news is that it's now in preview. Technical preview 1 was out just a few days ago, and we got a briefing of that yesterday, and I got to tell you, this is really a game-changing product, and I would recommend everyone should, anybody who's in the Azure space should take a look at that this product. So I think we had Charles Joy on the show a few weeks ago, correct? He gave us a little bit of...
Yeah, sometime in the fall, yeah.
Yeah, and he was actually one of the presenters yesterday at the thing, at the briefing, and this is now the official first release of Azure Stack. It's just to get our listeners caught up on what we talked about last time, it's essentially, you know, Azure in your data center, and that's exactly how it's being marketed. If you go to the Azure website, it actually says, you know, put Azure in your data center, and it's true to that particular definition. I was a little concerned about, you know, how they're going to market this. Actually, talking to Russell about this just earlier, and he was wondering if this would, you know, take away from the Azure as a public cloud offering. You know, like, is it competing by with Azure itself, the Azure Stack product? And I don't know. I mean, what I got out of it is that I don't think it is competing with Azure itself, because you still have to invest a lot in hardware to put Azure Stack in your data center. The hardware is still the biggest cost. What you do gain some efficiencies are with your development, your deployment lifecycle, the agility that you bring to the firm, because you get all these resources on demand now, and of course your development lifecycle, because you get all these cloud APIs right in your data center. So I don't think it competes directly, but what it does do, it positions it makes creates it like a stepping stone for companies to go to the public cloud. A lot of companies, as we know, in financial services, especially in the US, are a bit hesitant to move to the public cloud because there's issues with data sovereignty, and is concerned about privacy, etc. So this is a first step for them to at least move to that programming model, which is the PaaS programming model, which we've always talked about. And once they get comfortable with that, at some point in the future, they can say, you know what, I think the public cloud's mature enough. I think we can let go and trust it. And at that point, all their code just automatically deploys to the cloud with zero changes. So that's the promise that Azure Stack offers. It's an exact copy of Azure. All the APIs, well, most of the APIs, I'd say all of them, but made available to you in the data center.
So yeah, I mean, I guess the biggest take-up will be dev test environments then, yeah? Is that what you think would be the first people to take it, doing their dev test?
Yes, dev test is definitely one of the scenarios. Sorry, Evan, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I'm actually wouldn't be surprised, Russell, if we see, on-premises production workloads, right? Because I think people are comfortable with Hyper-V and System Center as their, you know, private cloud solutions, and what this will allow them to do is flip to a declarative model for that, and that, you know, so they get the advantages of the resource providers and, you know, and the kind of the structure that Azure brings without having to make the jump to public cloud like Sujeet was talking about.
Okay, so the DevOps, the ARM templates, and all that good stuff. Yeah.
I mean, that's my perspective. I mean, I'm sure we'll see some dev test stuff, but I think, you know, I talk to a lot of people that they love the idea of the resource providers and the declarative model and the provisioning capabilities, but they just can't go to public cloud for, you know, fill in the blank, you know, whatever reason.
Exactly. Yeah. And as I said, you know, the hardware requirements are not trivial. Okay, I mean, just to, before I think we may have talked about the hardware requirements in a previous show, but they only hit home for me when I actually saw them yesterday. So the minimum hardware requirement for this particular preview is a 12-core box with 96 gigabytes of RAM, okay, and lots of hard disks. So, you know, right off the bat, this is not going on my laptop. Now, having said that, there are obviously the usual gamut of websites out there which show you how to beat the system and do it. That's completely at your own risk if you want to try it that way. But the recommended, the minimum hardware requirements are 12 cores, 96 gig. Recommended is actually 16 core, 128 gig. Okay. And I just want to make one point before we continue on that discussion is that, you know, this is the almost everything that Azure does in your data center, right? I don't think it's not a trivial matter. It's not like, I mean, it's like you're going to like Bing or Google and say, I want to put your whole system on my laptop. You know, you can't do that. You can't put all of that on your laptop. It's just too much of stuff. Sorry, you were going to say something, guys? Go ahead.
Yeah. The one thing that kind of hit home for me with this is I've heard enterprise customers before asking for, you know, what's the on-prem alternative to this? So, like, you fill in the blank. So one of them was blob storage, was a big one before. It was like, you know, blob storage is kind of unique. It's this flat data store that we have in Azure that's awesome. But they said, what if I want to run an on-prem version of that? How do I do it? And that's not easily done, you know, right now, exactly. Because, you know, we couldn't port that over. But now this opens up that door. So I think it'll enable a lot of scenarios there. And like you said, since people get comfortable and get their apps ported at least to that API, then it becomes much easier to open up doors for future things.
Yep. And since you mentioned storage, so just, I mean, just want to set some expectations of what's available in the technical preview one and what will be available eventually in GA. So they do intend to fully support blobs, tables, and queues in the GA product. That's the expectation at this time. But currently in TP1, only blobs and tables are supported. Queues are not yet in there. Even for the web and mobile development, there is the app services there, but it's limited to web apps right now, and they're going to add the logic apps, mobile apps, and API apps very shortly. They're kind of going to stage some of these features in over time.
And Sujeet, how did they talk, or have you played with it enough to see? How does it work from like an update standpoint? Because, you know, something like the public cloud, we're constantly updating the version of the API, you know, to add new features or, you know, fix things, those kind of things. How does this work when it's, you know, on premises?
They do plan to update it at a very regular cadence. I don't think I'm at liberty to say what that is right now, but there is an expectation that it will be updated at a very frequent cadence.
But it's something that the customer can control. I wasn't really getting at like how quickly it would be updated. I was more like, is the customer, whoever's hosting this thing, actually in control of that update, or is it like it has to phone home and it does the updates automatically? I didn't know if they exposed that info.
They did not, and that's a good question. They didn't talk about exactly how it gets updated.
Okay.
So just the whole goal for this particular release is it's a single box release, first of all, right? There's no false assumptions over here that this is going to be a fully fault-tolerant system and things like that. It's not. It's a single box environment. It's meant for you to understand what goes into Azure Stack, understand so that developers and enterprises can figure out, you know, how they can get their apps created and deployed into the system. Because remember, when you log into an Azure system today in the cloud, you see a whole bunch of things. You see a whole bunch of templates, you see, you know, all these gallery items and all that stuff. that's all been put in there, right? That's not part of the base system. So when you install Azure Stack, it essentially shows up empty. And now you got to populate it with all your stuff. You got to populate it with your images. You got to populate it with your templates. You got to populate it with the kind of services that you want to offer to the customers, and the customers in that case are customers within your enterprise itself, you know, your the line of business people or wherever it is, because as an enterprise, you're going to install Azure Stack and further make it available to all the line of businesses within your firm. And then there's going to be some kind of a chargeback model that you'll establish with them. That's typically how they see this working. So you have to populate all those things. So there's a lot of focus on the old ARM templates. We talked about ARM in the past, but that's the main driving thing over here is creating a whole bunch of ARM templates to define what your VMs are going to look like, what your services are going to look like, and making sure that the gallery is populated with your applications, not with Microsoft applications, but with your apps.
And so you just wrap this up, does that this is something everybody can download right now if they had the proper hardware to run this on, right? But it's the bits and everything for the preview are out there, right, publicly available?
Absolutely. Everything is publicly available, including all the templates. There's a GitHub website set up with all the templates where you can go and get them as starting points. You could use them to populate it. They have Ubuntu, I forget, some variant of Linux VM that's been created just for Azure Stack. And, of course, you have the Windows images as well. So they've got IaaS, they've got PaaS, and they've got the some of the security pieces in there as well. So... I think the two things I want to point out is that the installation, you got to be careful. It takes a while. Some people have said it takes up to 4 hours to install. So this is a very complex install. It requires Windows Data Server 2016 Data Center Edition Technical Preview 4, at least. So if you already have that because you've been playing around with it, you can use that. But if you don't, they provide a VHDX file that you can use to boot your own, like a pre-configured instance of Windows Server 2016 TB4. And once you have that installed, then you can deploy all the Azure Stack components on top of that. What Charles had wanted me to mention to our listeners is that if you have problems, there's two particular links that we'll put in the show notes. He wants people to go to the Azure Stack Forum, aka.ms/AzureStackForum. Or if you have some sort of suggestion to improve the product, to go to aka.ms/AzureStackUserVoice. So those are the links. We'll put that in the show notes, but listeners should use those resources to get more information to solve their problems or make suggestions to improve it.
Yeah. Now, if you guys, if you really want to make your mind hurt, think about the fact that with Server 2016, you're going to be able to virtualize within a virtual machine, right? So you could do Hyper-V on a virtual server. So you could do Azure running Azure Stack running Azure VMs. I don't know why you would do that, but
if you've seen the movie Inception. It's the third level there. You got to watch it.
Oh, boy. Now, Cale, you put a couple of other links, security-related links. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. Just quickly, there's two things that kind of stood out this week. There's and I'm not up on these specs, but the ISO 27001 compliance. But there's a white paper that we published this week from the security team to basically kind of center around 13 security controls that are really appropriate for that compliance. And so basically it points out specifically in Azure the things that we're doing to address those things and kind of help with that. So people, especially, you know, the FinServ and some of those different verticals, if they're facing these types of compliance, these are great things to bring to your security team as far as what's being done in Azure or how we can effectively pass these kind of compliance measures with the things built into Azure. And the other one was around security too, which was some of the machine learning that's being used. So there's a product that was released a while back called Azure Security Center, which effectively is this PaaS type service that runs up in Azure to kind of, you can basically target applications or workloads that you have in Azure, and it can kind of help you out with what's happening there from a security sense. Like if people are maybe you forgot to close a port or something on one of your web servers or one of your servers that you have up there, or did something that's kind of like not compliant typically, the Security Center can make suggestions for that to help you fix that, as well as point you to partner solutions if one of those is most effective. But the thing that they're doing, they were speaking a little bit more about the machine learning that's involved behind Azure Security Center. And there's a blog post about it. We can put it in the show notes, but it's basically around two different things around the detection, some of the next-gen detection stuff that they're doing, and then the some of the simplified security measures. So, like, on the detection side, it's really about leveraging all those features, actually, that we have in Azure for machine learning to build some sort of rules-based things to be able to identify these workloads that have issues or these different types, you know, for lack of a better word, attacks and things like that that might happen. These kind of things can help feed that system to help make it better, as well as, you know, like noise reduction and stuff like that, like false positives and things like that. So it's interesting stuff to take a look at, seeing how we're leveraging some of our own products to turn around and help Azure.
That's great. Thanks for that, Cale. So I just wanted to, I started off by saying that Russell and myself were over in Seattle, and one of the reasons we're here is, well, the main reason we're here is we're here for an event that Microsoft hosts for its internal employees. It's called Tech Ready. Maybe some of our listeners have heard about it before. It's sort of like a Build and PDC, well, it used to be PDC, but now called Build and Ignite. Those are the two conferences, public conferences that I held, and I guess Tech Ready is our internal version of those conferences. And the reason it's internal is because they talk about a lot of confidential stuff here, stuff that's not yet released, stuff that's coming out, and it's a big investment that Microsoft makes in these in this particular event. They do it twice a year. We get to go for it every now and then whenever there's sufficient new stuff to come and check out here. So it's where we come and meet all the product teams. We get all the sessions where in the tracks that we want to, just like you would at Ignite or Build. And so that's why we're over here. And Russell Young is happens to be one of our listeners of the podcast. He had reached out to us. He's from the UK, and he's a premier field engineer. But I'm going to let him introduce himself. Russell, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thanks. First, I think just to say thanks very much for the podcast. So I've been listening to it for quite some time, and I don't know if you guys realize how valuable it is to people like myself. So I have a fairly big commute most times, either I'm on the way to the office or on the way to a customer, and that's normally dead time. So listening to your podcast is really invaluable. As your stuff is changing so fast, it's really difficult to keep up with it, and putting the time aside to do all the reading, it's far easier for me to sit in a car and let you guys do that. So I really appreciate the service that you guys offer. Find it really good, so thank you for that. The reason I wanted to come on here really was just to talk a little bit about the Microsoft services side of the organization. So we talk a lot about Azure on the podcast in terms of the technology that it offers. But I was at an event that Microsoft hosted in the UK last year called Future Decoded, and I was working on one of the stands there. And most of the customers that we had coming up to us were coming up for coffee because we had a coffee machine on our stand. What they didn't realize was that Microsoft have got this huge services organization in the background that can provide a lot of added value. So I thought it would be a good opportunity to come on the podcast and just to explain briefly on that side of the business. And that's the side that of the organization that I work in as well. So PFE is part of the premier organization in services, and there's also MCS, which a lot of people would have heard of, the Microsoft Consulting Services. But premier is a little bit different in that we offer premier agreements to just about any customer, but it tends to be enterprise sort of size customers. And that organization then split into two kinds of services. We've got the reactive side, who will deal with support requests that come through. And then we've got a proactive side, which is the side that I work in. And from the proactive business, we've got premier field engineers like myself, who are kind of specialists in certain areas of technology. And we'll get asked by an account manager via the customers to come out on site and look at specific issues or give them specific training. We tend to look at three different areas. It's education, assessment, and operation. So helping them run whatever it is they're trying to run more efficiently. So my specialization is in Azure development. So I do a lot of work around Azure on the PaaS side, working with customers on development teams on trying to use Azure services in the best way. And that's one of the reasons I ended up looking for a job at Microsoft just earlier last year. One of the reasons I came in is because I was an enterprise customer. I didn't really know much about Premier at all at the time, didn't really know it existed. But I managed to get involved with Azure and looking at our on-premises architecture, which had been in place for around 15 years. It was costing quite a lot of money. I won't say in monetary values, because you guys can look me up on LinkedIn or something and find out where I used to work, and I don't want to give that game away. So anyway, we had a fairly sophisticated, mature on-premises solution with a fairly large part of the organization dedicated to looking after hard disks and deployments and all that kind of stuff. And I was the product development director on the other side of the business that was looking to try and change stuff as fast as possible and get new products and features out there. And the two sides of the business are kind of rubbing up against each other, because IT directors tend to want to keep things as they are, because then things don't go wrong. But I thought it was about time to look at Azure. I've been using Azure as a testing ground before and just playing with it over the past few years. And then I looked at, looking at all these virtual machines that we had. I think we had about 44 different virtual machines in our production site. And then we had that duplicated for pre-production and then another copy for staging, your UAT. And then we had all that as well in a DR site as well. So you've got all these VMs sat there, using CPU 24/7, using all the storage, each one with their own Windows licensing to look after, updates to look after, and so on. Our application was fairly simple, fairly straightforward. It ran on IIS, it was all C#.NET. We had some Oracle in the background as the database, but also some SQL. And spent the last sort of 6 months of my time at that job looking at seeing how much more efficient we could make it in terms of cost as well as operations, by moving to Azure. And I calculated we would say it would cost us an eighth of what we were spending in terms of the total. And part of that was down to the efficiencies of, well, it was nearly all down to the efficiencies of PaaS. So platform as a service just really makes your life a lot easier. So when stuff isn't getting used, you're just simply not paying for it, which makes a really great story. But some of the things that I've come across with customers, and it was the same at my last company, you look at doing a comparison of the cost between your on-premises data centers and Azure, and people tend to do a like-for-like. So they look at, okay, I've got these 44 VMs with this much storage. I've got this much storage I need for my requirement for backups, and I want point-in-time restore for the last, I don't know how many days or how many hours you want to go back. So they add all that up and then just say, well, what's that going to cost me in Azure? What's it going to cost me in AWS and what have you? And surprise, surprise, it's not that much cheaper. You're saving on the electricity costs and so on, but somebody's still got to bear that cost, and the operational cost is the same. But when you move towards a PaaS model, that changes dramatically. So you've got the fact that storage in Azure, the default level, you've got three copies already, so the resilience is built in for you. You've got point-in-time restore in SQL Azure straight out of the box. So it's very difficult to try and do a like-for-like comparison. So you have to try and look at, what are the actual features that I want out of the system and break it down that way. My role is pretty much doing that kind of consultancy with customers, looking at what they have, looking at their requirements, see whether they can move to PaaS fully, whether they want to publish their software as SaaS out to their customers, or we still get quite a lot of it, is the IaaS side of things, so customers moving towards that.
Now, Russell, that was a very good introduction there, but let me ask you, what are some of the major inhibitors that you've seen to people to move to the cloud? I thought you mentioned earlier that there are people can be a problem, right? People at the don't always like to move to the cloud. And how do you kind of get around that?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think people are the problem moving to the cloud. So, organizations that are fairly mature have built up a lot of experience and expertise probably spent a lot of money on training and getting teams in place to look after all this stuff. They probably invested in hardware, possibly invested in property as well to do all this stuff. So it is a big move, and it's a big mind shift for people to go that way. And because of that, they've kind of got this inbuilt reluctance, and I think a lot of what people give you are just excuses as to why they don't want to move, and they're not that valid when you start looking at the real reasons behind it. So, you know, security is a big one, and that gets chucked out there every time. But in my experience, you know, it's just not valid at all. You'll find that Azure and the security, and you read up all the white papers like the one you just mentioned earlier on the ISO 27001 compliance, it's going to be far more secure, and the processes and practices that Microsoft put in place are far better than anything that you're going to have or be able to keep up to date with in an on-premise environment. So those kinds of arguments, you know, it is a mind shift change from the customer's point of view. I think it's a matter of talking to the right people. So when you get to the senior management teams, the IT teams, the IT directors, they might have that reluctance built in. But even, you know, even the legal teams on some of these companies, they're much more open to it. That's my experience anyway.
It's funny you say that, Russell, because I was just talking to somebody the other day that they said they were talking about, you know, a customer that was looking at Azure, and they were concerned that, you know, our compliance, you know, we weren't going to have the right compliance necessary for them. And, you know, once we started digging into it and I pointed them to the Trust Center and just this, you know, incredible list of various certifications and client and compliances and, you know, worldwide stuff I've never even heard of, right? You know, combinations of letters that I've never even seen before in my life. And, it, you know, it was really funny because the person I was talking to walked away and said, well, I'm going to bet some money that the customer that's asking about this has almost none of these. Right, and it's for some reason they assume that we're not going to have this stuff, but the reality is there's a huge we spend a ton of time and effort getting all that, and chances are in the end we're probably going to maintain it and keep it better than most on-premises data centers, right? Because that's what we do.
Yeah, I mean, there's three pillars to it, really. There's the fact that Azure was built from the ground up with security in mind, so the technology's there. You've got all the processes and the certification and the controls and the auditing that happens. And then the third wing, really, is about the support and the education that we offer as well. So being able to teach our customers how to, you know, benefit from that security and the learnings that we do and make sure that they're developing secure code. So one of the workshops that we deliver as PFE is about secure development lifecycle and making sure they're aware of, you know, because, you know, anybody can write an application and put it out there that can be susceptible to some kind of an attack. If you're not aware of what those attacks are and how to defend against them, then it doesn't matter what platform you're running on, your application is at risk. It might be sandboxed and stuff from the point of view of other tenants. But, you know, you're still opening yourself up to denial of service or injection attacks or overposting attacks and so on. So we give that kind of training, and it's one of the things we look out for when we do our assessments as well. We'll look at somebody's application stack and their architecture and, you know, just ask them the questions if they're aware of these security flaws and what are they doing about it. And one of the big ones is making sure they're not writing their own identity providers and security providers and cryptography solutions and stuff, because the teams at Microsoft, you know, we're spending a lot of money on those guys, making sure that they are up to date and they're at the very forefront of what's going on. And that's why there's so many security patches go out all the time. They're just constantly keeping on top of that. And you know, nobody else is going to be able to compete with that kind of level of expertise.
Yeah, I think the one thing you said too, Russell, that's important to think about is, especially, you know, kind of, I'll call them old school companies, but companies that have, you know, for 20, 30 years have been running these things and managing the data center manually themselves. You know, when we approach them, you know, or when the public cloud discussion comes up, they could say, you know, we have a lot of manual processes and we have a lot of, like, high touch environment, I'll call it, where they got a lot
of pets.
Yeah, so it's like, I think that's the real value for like PFEs and MCS from that side of the house, because we have a lot of expertise in the cloud and can come there and say, we can analyze your application, that's what you were alluding to, like, you know, look at their apps and say, here's the models you should be following to make it more automated or more repeatable or, you know, more scalable in the cloud or more secure even. But
yeah. I mean, and one of the things, you know, you've got these fairly large companies that are falling behind because it's slower for them to deploy and release stuff because of all this change management process and the sort of the concerns that they have over putting change through the system. And you're finding now that, you know, by being putting your head in the sand in that way and ignoring the cloud, you're opening yourself up to as a target for competitors because you've got these startup companies of one or two people now that can leverage that, you know, billions and billions of dollars that Microsoft have invested in hardware. They've got access to that straight away, and they don't have to pay for it unless they're using it. So it's a great way of growing a very small business. So there's no upfront investment, and as long as they've got their charge model right, they can access all this stuff, you know, straight out the box and grow it as their customer base grows.
Now, Russell, you mentioned about PaaS earlier, right? And I think that's something that we've always preached on the podcast, so that PaaS is the holy grail of Azure, of moving to the cloud. But I think it's fair to say that if a company has been doing business using VMs for the longest time, you just can't move from VMs to PaaS overnight, right? It's a fairly complex process, right, to take what they've traditionally had on VMs and move it into a PaaS-style environment. So how does that factor in with your discussions with these companies?
Well, that depends hugely, really. So if you're talking to a company that has developed the software in-house, then the whole discussion is a lot simpler. If they're just doing stuff like, you know, firing up a VM that's got Windows Server on it, that's running IIS, that's pretty much it, then you've just got to start looking at, okay, so have you written it in such a way that it supports load balancing? Can I make it multi-instance? Are you writing to the hard disk, or are you using session objects in process and all that kind of stuff? So that becomes a straightforward thing. And migrating those kind of web apps is really straightforward. And the same with the SQL database stuff. There's you know, fairly small reasons now why you wouldn't want to go to SQL PaaS versus IaaS. And it just, you know, if there were features and stuff that's missing, there are a couple, but it's pretty much feature complete. And I always recommend that people start from the SaaS side and then the PaaS side and then move down to IaaS and so on. And if you're looking at it that way, then you're going to get the best out of the system and be the most efficient. So it's not as hard. The trickier ones are guys, VMs on-premise, where the software that's been installed from a third party, they might not have support from that vendor for it, so they don't know exactly how it works or what the risks are in moving it. But even there, we can make some fairly good savings just by using a bit of Azure automation. So most of them don't want those environments available over the night or over the weekend. So we just put some very simple, I think it's about a two-line script to size those VMs down overnight or shut off the extra instances. And, you know, straight away you're saving a large portion of your monthly cost.
Good point. So you could those kind of tricky situations, you just migrate them to IaaS. You don't have to necessarily refactor them right away because they have third-party software and things like that.
Yeah, and typically it's going to be a mix of both. So there may be some IaaS bits and pieces in there that they still want to keep. The typical one used to be the Active Directory stuff, but even now we've got directory services, so people are moving to that now. A lot of interest in that area. So the need for IaaS is disappearing.
So
well, we
go ahead, Devin.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, and you know, we just, and I can't remember the official name of it, but you know, we put into public preview the Active Directory as a service, right? We actually get a DC in your virtual network, that but you don't have to manage it or own it, right? We manage it for you, and it ties back into your Azure AD. So, you know, kind of like Russell was saying, where you get, if Azure AD, which is PaaS, actually I guess Azure AD is probably closer to SaaS. If it doesn't meet your needs, well, now you have this DC that is still completely and totally managed by somebody else that gives you the policy and some of the other things that you can't get with Azure AD.
Yeah, being able to join machines to the domain virus as well, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, again, the need for having an on-premises directory controller really goes away to make
sure. Absolutely.
That's great. So I just want to close out by asking, I mean, Russell is relatively new to Microsoft. And I mean, Russell, is there anything more that you want to talk about? I wanted to get your opinions on your first few months at Microsoft otherwise.
Well, I can probably combine the two together. So, one of my first engagements that I had. As I was fairly new to Microsoft, I didn't have that many customer bookings. So there was a problem came up with a, well, not a problem, but a request from a customer to get some support on media services. So they were a fairly large UK broadcasting company with a very short deadline. I think it was about 2 weeks before they wanted to go live on Azure Media Services to broadcast live some football matches over the whole season. So I got called to go out on site, not knowing a massive amount about media services and being fairly new to Microsoft. But what was really nice was going on site, giving the customer some comfort by having a Microsoft guy there. They didn't know how new I was, so that wasn't too much of a problem. But you know, I could listen to them, find out what they were after, find out what comfort they were after. Basically, they were moving from one media provider to Azure because they'd been let down in the past. So they wanted to try media services and see how that worked out for them. But it was, from my point of view, it was great because I felt quite daunted, first of all, before I turned up by the prospect of doing this thing and talking to the customer about it. But, you know, I was able to help them out with quite a few questions that they had, but I was also able to contact the product group here in the States and get a support group together that were able to help the customer fairly quickly. So, you know, you've got this massive resource. It's like being part of 100,000 person team. So yeah, that was really nice. And ever since that experience, I've never felt out of my depth going on customer sites. You feel like you've got that backup there and that support. People don't expect you to know everything. So you go on site, you let them know what you're, you know, as much as you can about your experience and what you know. But the rest of it, you can find out and get back to them, or you can get the guys straight on the call. So, that was the first one. And then since then, I've done quite a bit with Azure Search, which is another great service. And again, getting hold of the product group there and finding out what's the latest, what's the roadmap, how's it coming. And you're able to give that information onto the customer as well, as long as it's not secret at the time, obviously, because it's if it's public domain knowledge. So it's great. And API management being the other one. So some really good services there that get some really good value out of.
Excellent, thank you. And since you mentioned football, I'm an Arsenal fan. Which is your team?
So I don't follow football at all.
Oh, okay.
So that was the awkward part of the conversation on that particular engagement. They were asking me the same things, and I was like, I've never even heard of this football league that you're talking about.
Okay, never mind. So, yeah. All right. Well, it's great having Russell over here on the show with us. Guys, any more questions for him before we wind up?
No, this is great. Thanks for all the good words about the podcast, Russell. It makes it all worthwhile.
No, you're welcome, Evan. So keep it up. It's great stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Russell. This was great. You coming and sharing your insights here.
Thanks, Kyle.
All right. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.